okay here. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you got some peace and quiet in the meditation there. It's always nice before hearing hopefully some Dhamma, to actually be a bit peaceful and a bit quiet. The topic I was going to talk about this evening is the topic of happiness, which I think is probably very, very relevant for everybody, I hope. And the obvious reason I want to talk about this is because in my own life, the idea of happiness, or the pursuit of happiness, or the search for happiness, has obviously been very relevant, as it is for almost anybody. It's always one of the most important things, I think, the fundamental things for any human being, is the search for happiness and the desire for happiness of some form or another. And when I use the phrase happiness, I mean happiness in a very sort of broad context, a very kind of broad idea of happiness, because happiness can be so many things. And one aspect of happiness is just ordinary pleasures that we have, you know, sensual pleasures like good food or seeing a nice movie or doing something we like, relationships, etc. That's one aspect of it. And of course, this is one of the desires that we always pursue. Other aspects of happiness are more like spiritual happinesses, like we have the happiness of contentment or joy in the mind, tranquility, peace, etc. That's another side of happiness. And we all recognize the happiness when we have it, you know, what joy in the mind feels like. It's a very pleasurable feeling here, as is the sense of peace and tranquility. So when I say that we all pursue happiness, then that's what I basically mean. We all pursue these positive feelings, these things which are, in one way or another, are superior or preferable to something else. And I have certainly noticed that in my own life, how important these things are. And that's why I was so fascinated when I came across the Buddha's teachings. Because suddenly when I came across the Buddha's teachings, I found something which answered all these things which I've always been wondering about. How do you find happiness? Where is true happiness? What is true happiness? And we all wander around in a kind of sense of darkness, not really knowing exactly where to look for these things. And then suddenly a teaching was there, which actually made clear these very things. And it was almost like a perfect match in a sense. Here there is this great search, this great desire for some sort of contentment, something positive in life. And here is a teaching which matches that desire perfectly. And I remember very distinctly one of the most, in a sense, important experiences I had as a Buddhist, when something really clicked for me, was when I heard the Four Noble Truths. I'm sure most of you are very familiar with the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are usually explained as the truth of suffering, the origin of suffering, the end of suffering, and the path leading to the end of suffering. But when the first time I heard the alternative explanation of these truths, as focusing on happiness rather than on suffering, something really clicked for me. And I thought, well, this is exactly what I've been looking for in my life. Because if you consider, I'm sure you heard this before, but if you consider the Four Noble Truths in the suffering sense, it's very easy to see how this also can be turned around and actually relates to happiness. Because the end of suffering, of course, is nothing but the beginning of happiness. The path leading to the end of suffering is nothing but the path leading to happiness. And the very first noble truth, the noble truth of suffering itself, well, obviously, if you understand suffering fully and completely, where it is, then where that suffering isn't, is where happiness is going to be. So you can turn these noble truths around and look upon them in terms of happiness instead. I think that Buddha always taught this truth in terms of suffering. So the suffering aspect is obviously the more profound one. But very often, and that was the case for me, it was basically too profound for me in the beginning. I couldn't really relate to it. I didn't really understand what was going on there. And when I heard heard this truth rephrased in terms of happiness instead, something clicked for me here. And I thought, this is it. This is finally a teaching which answers the most fundamental, most basic desires in my life, and from what I can gather, also anybody else's lives. Because basically this thing, I think, is true for everybody. We all desire these things. And it's not only the Four Noble Truths, but you find these things also being the case in most of the Buddha's teachings. There's a very broad focus on happiness and contentment of some kind throughout the teachings, from just basic happiness in ordinary life, in daily life, how to interact between people, how to interact with our employers, employees, family members, anybody. And the suttas are full of this stuff. Everywhere you can find this in the suttas. How to gain happiness in it for future lives, and of course how to attain the ultimate happiness, which is Nibbana itself. And it's everywhere in the suttas. It's one of those very, in a sense, sad conditions of human life that when you realize that what we all really desire, what we all want, this is happiness of some form or another. We want this contentment, something which can fulfill us. And yet when you look at human beings generally, they actually get the exact opposite. They usually get suffering rather than happiness. And this is of course one of the, in a sense, one of the terrible predicaments of human existence, not only human existence, but animal existence, any type of being really. That we go around longing for something and we find the exact opposite. It's quite sad, isn't it, in a sense, that it has to be like that. But that is generally the way it is. So because it is like that, that is of course the reason why the Buddha, after he became fully enlightened, he decided that I'm going to teach the Dhamma, because his enormous compassion arose in him when he realized that there's all these beings out there having a hard time, having a difficult time, desiring happiness, and instead getting the exact opposite, namely suffering. And from that great compassion obviously arose the Buddha's teaching career for 45 years after his enlightenment, when he decided to teach people precisely for that reason. The question that arises, why is it that the Buddha is able to teach about happiness? What is it in that the Buddha realized which has to do with happiness? How come the Buddha is more able to understand these matters compared to your average ordinary person? What is it that he actually saw? What is it that he realized? The point here is that what the Buddha actually realized on his light of enlightenment was essentially what it boils down to is seeing reality as it actually is. He saw things as it actually are. And this is in sharp contrast to how one ordinary sees things. And that is precisely where the problem lies. Because the problem is, from the Buddhist point of view, is that we don't understand reality as it actually is. We're seeing something which is not there. We're seeing things in a kind of biased way. And it's for that reason that we can't, when we act on that lack of understanding, lack of that wrong view, if you like, you act on something which is basically not reality, then of course you're going to make mistakes. So the Buddha, actually, he awoke to reality and he saw reality as it actually is. And that's why the Buddha, in many places in the suttas, he's called, for example, the eye of the world. He is the eye of the world because he saw reality as it actually is. And then he taught it to other people. So they also could open their eyes, so to speak. So he became the eye for human beings and for animals and all other beings. Of course, the important things, the three important things that the Buddha saw on his night of enlightenment was, first of all, was the idea of or the fact of rebirth. It was a fact of karma. And finally, the last thing was the fact of suffering. And based on these things, because he had seen the way things actually are, he could then tell people, this is the way it is. And because it is this way, you have to act this way to be happy. You cannot act that way to be happy. And when people got faith in the Buddha, because he was such an exceptional person, they got the same view as he had. And then they aligned their view in accordance with reality. And this is the point here with this thing we call right view. Right view is basically a way of aligning your view of the world in accordance with reality, and with the way things actually are. And to give you some idea of the importance of this, I'm just going to use some very kind of basic similes to illustrate the point I'm making here. What happens if you have wrong view? It's a bit like, you can imagine you're sitting at home in your house, you're feeling very safe, everything is very fine, and you're expecting a friend to arrive at your house. You expect somebody to come, and then of course the doorbell rings, and you go to the front door, because the view in your mind is that this is your friend, you open the door straight away. But unfortunately, it so happens that it isn't your friend. It happens to be a burglar. Huh? So you open the door, the burglar storms in, knocks you unconscious, steals all your nice valuables, and takes off, and you never see him again there. And of course, that's suffering. Yeah? And this is essentially what happens. If you've got wrong view of something, yeah, then you act on that wrong view, and it tends to become suffering because you're acting on the wrong view. Huh? You have wrong information about reality. Yeah? Because of your wrong information about reality, your actions tend to conform to that wrong information, so you do something stupid. Yeah? Or you can, for example, you can also see the same thing happening, for example, in an investment. You invest on the stock market. Some smart friend, who at least you think is very smart, he would maybe recommend a share which he thinks is going to rise very sharply. But he may not be aware of the latest information that, you know, this company is actually in big trouble, and the share is likely to go down. So you buy it, again, on wrong view, because you're not aware of the information which is available elsewhere, and you lose a lot of money because you follow the advice of your friend. So this is, in essence, what happens when you have a wrong view, is that you act upon wrong view. When you act upon wrong view, you're basically liable to make mistakes and to fall into problems. But of course, these worldly kind of wrong views, these things I just mentioned, are trivial compared to the wrong view in the larger context of things. If you have serious wrong view about life, about how life works, obviously the consequences of that wrong view is going to be far, far worse. And that's why, a classical example is that if you don't believe in rebirth and karma, if you are what is quite typical in the Western society these days to be a materialist, in other words, you think that when you die, it's all over, it's all finished. Well, if you really hold that view strongly, that everything is finished when you die, you may come to the conclusion, well, it doesn't matter so much if I am a good person, as long as I don't get into prison or anything like that. Doesn't matter if I'm what I do, so I can cheat a bit here, cheat a bit there, lie a bit here, lie a bit there, and it doesn't really matter so much. When it all comes to the end of my life, I will pass away, that will be the end of it, and no problems. And that's, of course, from the Buddhist point of view, you get a nasty surprise when you pass away. And that is the problem with wrong view. And then, of course, because from a Buddhist point of view, you can actually get a very unfavorable rebirth. And that is, that is going to be so much more suffering than the tiny bit of pleasure you may have gained from, being immoral or being stupid in this life. So the consequences are enormous of wrong view. And that's why when the Buddha arose in the world, he saw reality as it actually is. He was able to make people understand where happiness is to be found because he had understood reality. And this is the gift of the Buddha to the world. This is why Buddhism is so precious, because from a Buddhist point of view, it's only really a Buddha who is able to teach right view in its full, absolutely full context, to its full extent. So we have, and that is why, when I look around and I see the search, the desire for happiness in all of us, including myself, and you see how important it is that we all want happiness all the time. And you see the beautiful teaching of the Buddha, there's this perfect match there, this beautiful kind of thing coming together. And this is one of the things which makes me have so much faith in Buddhism, in the Buddhist teaching, precisely because it answers just those things that all beings are really searching for, whether they are visible beings or invisible beings. It answers precisely that question, which is the deepest desire, the most profound search that we all have, so to speak. I just want to maybe focus a little bit on how this desire for happiness tends to play out in our daily lives, because it's easy enough to intellectually accept that we all desire happiness, but sometimes our actions maybe betray our real desire even more than actually our intellect, how we think about these matters. And just consider a day in your life. Consider what you do, from the moment you get up in the morning till you go back to bed again. You get dressed in the morning. You have to decide on some sort of clothes. How do you decide that? What you're going to wear? How do you decide what you have for breakfast? Again, it's very obvious. You decide something which you think is going to make you happy in one way or another, pleasurable. How do you travel to work? What sort of do you go by car? Do you go by train? Do you go by bicycle? Maybe you think you're going to help the environment by going by bicycle. What sort of newspaper do you read? What sort of friends do you hang out with at work? What do you have for lunch again? What do you watch on TV? What do you go to the movies? And if you look at all these decisions, they always comes down, I think it's probably very clear to you, always comes down to where is happiness to be found? Where is most happiness to be found? How can I squeeze most possible happiness out of this life, basically? And it's also true for our more long, these are all the daily decisions we take, but it's also true for long-term decisions. You decide where you're going to live. You decide what company you're going to work for. You decide which profession you're going to have, what sort of education you want to have. And all of these things are obviously always, again, based on what you think is going to make you happy in some way or another. I'm not talking about, this is not necessarily a very simple form of happiness. It's not the sort of thing, you know, oh, this is going to just be a kind of pleasure. Sometimes it can be like, almost like a thing, like a principle you want to live for. But if you want to live for a principle, then obviously following that principle is going to make you feel, give some sense of happiness. And even so, people who are, have a kind of maybe masochistic tendency, well, the reason they have a masochistic tendency is because that also gives them a sense of happiness in a kind of strange kind of way. And also consider, well, why are you here today? Well, presumably you're here today because you hope that maybe I can get something out of coming to the Buddha site. Maybe I can hear something which I can use in my life. Again, you choose your religion or your lifestyle or your way of life. You choose it according to where you think it's going to bring you happiness, where it's going to bring you something beneficial. Why am I here tonight? Why do I sit here giving this talk? Well, because I think it's going to bring me some happiness. So again, it's the same, exactly the same principle. Why did I become a monk? Well, again, because I think that there's going to be some happiness connected with living the monastic life. There's no other reason. I'm not a monk just because I think it's a, you know, intellectually good idea. I think it's going to bring me some happiness, obviously. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this. And you can even look at this in the very tiny details of life, and it becomes very, very obvious. All the little, tiny little things that we do all the time, like just like blinking your eyes. Why do you blink your eyes? Well, it's obviously get away from suffering. There's some suffering there, which is, you know, you want to take away. In other words, it's again the search for happiness, search for pleasure, which comes into the picture there. Or you move in your seat, you wriggle your toes, wriggle your fingers, move your head, move your neck, whatever you do. All these things tend to be based on the same thing, the search for comfort, the search for something to satisfy you. So it becomes very fascinating when you look at it this way, because it becomes very clear that it's not only this an intellectual idea that we want to become happy or want to be happy, but actually it's something that is almost inherent in our very being, and completely unconsciously we are searching for comfort, searching for happiness, searching for getting away from discomfort all the time. Whether we think about it or not, it's just happening automatically. So you start to see here the degree to which this is actually true in human life. So that is why it becomes so important. And this is, in a sense, this is actually also where the famous teaching of the Buddha called the Patthitasamuppada comes into the picture. Patthitasamuppada is this quite a profound teaching. But basically it says that very core of it is that, well, because we are feeling beings, because there's feeling, we feel in the body, we feel in the mind. Because of that, craving arises and we act on that craving. That's what's happening throughout the day. Whether we think about it or not, this is what's going on. And that's why we're always searching for that happiness. Because feeling gives rise to craving, which then ultimately gives rise to rebirth again. So the search for happiness is very, very much part of our very being. It goes very much to the core of human existence, in a sense. So then it becomes very important when the Buddha teaches about these things, because then we actually get a much more clear picture of where we should search for happiness, what is important, because the Buddha had the right view, he saw reality as it actually is. He can give us more direction in the search, rather than just blindly following our desires all the time, moving here, moving there. You can put some direction into it, some meaning into this search. You can actually go in the right way. And one of the important distinctions that the Buddha made in this idea of happiness, he made the distinction between spiritual happiness and worldly happiness. And this becomes a very important distinction. And as you obviously all are going to guess straight away, is that the Buddha obviously recommended trying to focus on the spiritual happiness rather than the worldly happiness. If it comes, it's probably very obvious straight away here. But I want to discuss this in a bit, in a slightly different way from usual, and some of the experience I have made myself, in particular some of the things I've read about, because I've come across some interesting experiments that were done in the US. And these experiments, basically, one of them was done back in the 1970s, and it was focusing basically on worldly happiness, on exactly how worldly happiness works. And the other one was done quite recently, also in the US, and that focused more on spiritual happiness and how spiritual happiness works. And these are basically psychological experiments, looking at how the brain and how what happens when we have what happens with happiness, basically, in human beings. And the experiment that was done back in the 1970s, I think it was even at Harvard University, so very quite prestigious in that sense. They basically showed that the human happiness, humans are born with a particular level of happiness. And that level of happiness that you're born with, some people are born with more, some people maybe with less. I can't remember exactly how they measured the actual degree. But the point was that that level they were born with, that's the level they tended to be at throughout their lives. It didn't actually tend to change all that much. So they tend to be born there, and then throughout their lives, they would actually stay on that level, and when they passed away, they would be pretty much on the same place. Sometimes slightly lower, but tended to be pretty much in the same place. But of course, on the way there, across throughout your life, what happens, something happens to you. You get some kind of pleasure. For example, take a very small pleasure, like you have a nice meal. And when you have a nice meal, what happens is like you have like a bit of a peak experience coming up. But as soon as that meal is over, that peak disappears, of course, and you come down again. And when you come down again, you come down exactly to the same level you were before. Come back to your baseline, in a sense, which is your base happiness. And of course, if that happens to you, if you see that there was a peak experience by having a nice meal, then that craving arises. You think, okay, I was happy. The happiness came because of the meal, so I want to have another good meal, right? So next time you feel hungry, you want to have a good meal again because of that. So then you go out, you find another good meal, and the same thing happens again. You have a peak experience, but lo and behold, it comes down and bang to the same level as before. And you can see how this can become very frustrating after a while. You try to find happiness in sensuality, you search for it all the time, but every time you do it, it comes back down again to the level it was before. And you never get anywhere. You're not actually getting anywhere. And you can have, there can be larger happiness. I mean, a meal is a very trivial happiness, but it can be larger happiness. Let's say you get a promotion in your job, an unexpected promotion. It can be like a very big happiness, and it can last for a long time. It can maybe last for weeks. You can feel happy about that. Maybe you get a good salary increase together with your promotion. But surely enough, after a few weeks, you get used to that new job. It becomes part of your sort of your everyday life, and there's nothing special about it anymore. And slowly but surely, it comes back down again to where you were before. And then it comes down again to exactly the same level, maybe a little bit lower than it was before. The biggest kind of happiness maybe that people often have is the happiness of falling in love. I think some people say that it can last like for maybe a year and a half sometimes, can go on for a long time. But eventually, even that sort of, you know, big happiness, and particularly when you're young, you know, you still haven't experienced so much suffering with relationships and all this, it can go on for a long time, and you feel very happy about it, of course, very, very happy. But then, of course, surely enough, it comes back down again to earth after about, a year or whatever it takes, and you're down to square one, back to square one again. And sometimes you get these people who are, what do they call them, serial monogamists or something, which just have one relationship after the other. And very often, I think, that is based on the sort of high that you can have from falling in love. And you have that high, but of course when it disappears, you wonder what's going on, something must be wrong with the relationship. And you break up with your partner and you find somebody else. And you have the same story happens again. It lasts for a while and then it disappears, and you have the same problem. And when you look at the world of sensuality, the world of the worldly pleasures, praise and blame, fame and what's the opposite of fame? Like being obscure in a sense, obscurity, happiness, pleasure, and displeasure, you realize that it's incredibly frustrating and incredibly, it's not never getting you anywhere. You get one pleasure after the other, you crave after it because it gives you some happiness, but then you come back down again. It doesn't get you anywhere. And then because it doesn't get you anywhere, you crave for more of it. You try again and again and again and again. And this is how most people go out throughout their lives. Work, basically, this is how most lives are. Always this search for happiness, which never is satisfactory, never gives you any real lasting happiness. And that's, you know, it's a kind of a sad predicament. And this is what the Buddha said, and that's why, of course, he taught the Dhamma. And then you also have the negative side of sensuality. Might as well talk about that as well, because that is obviously also important. And the same experiment they showed, at Harvard University back in the 70s, they showed that if you have a negative sensual experience, say you get a demotion rather than a promotion in your job, you have a big, go down into depression because you get a demotion. But slowly and surely, you build your way back up again. And when you come back up again, you come pretty much back to the level you were before. Or the most traumatic, again, is maybe a breakup in a relationship. And sometimes people feel, you know, even suicidal if they have a nice relationship that gets broken up. But again, if you hang in there and you don't do anything stupid, then it's only a matter of time and things, you know, sort themselves out. And you get back again up to the level you were, you're pretty much where you were before again. So you go down and you come up again. So basically, life for most people who don't practice any kind of spiritual path, it's a bit like this up and down, up and down, up and up, up and down. Like one of these, what is it called, this heart diagram. So when you see the heart, what is it called? ECG or something like that. Whatever. But the thing is that every time after each one of these, you come back down to the same level, the same flat line level again. So that is the world of sensuality, the world of worldly happiness. And that's basically how it works. And for me, that was a great eye-opener when I read that. I thought, wow, this really makes good sense to me. I can really relate to that. And what often happens, of course, is because in your frustration and trying to find more happiness in this world, often you end up doing stupid things. You do things which may be immoral or illegal. And then you really create more unhappiness for yourself. You're trying to sort of raise your level of happiness. Maybe you want to make a lot of money, so you do something immoral, you know, on the stock market or something like that. There's one monk in the monastery who was an ex-stockbroker. And he always tells me how immoral that trade can be. I can't really say everybody in that trade is immoral, but how common it is for people in that trade to do things which are a bit dodgy. And of course, because of greed, because you try to squeeze happiness out of this thing here. So in that case, if you do that, then actually you may have a peak experience, but then when you come down, you will tend to come further down than you were before. That makes it even worse. So in your desperation, you actually end up doing really stupid things. But then there was this other experiment, and this was the experiment about which was more concerned with, if you like, spiritual happiness. And this was done very recently also in the States. You may have read about it. I think the University of Wisconsin is where it was. And this was done by neurosurgeons in the U.S. Together with the Dalai Lama. Dalai Lama was one of the main collaborators in this particular experiment. And what these researchers had found is that there are certain parts in the brain which tend to become very active when you feel happiness. Happiness here means like joy, any kind of happiness really. And the other parts of the brain which become active if you feel depressed, you feel down. And obviously this was very, very interesting, and they did lots of experiments. And because they had the Dalai Lama as a collaborator on these experiments, they actually used Buddhist monks as the laboratory animals in this experiment. And they found, very interestingly enough, is that these monks, who most of them were very senior monks, they've been monks for 20, 30 years, much longer than I've been a monk, they found that their level of happiness, according to how the brain was lit up on these scans, they did these brain scans on them, was just completely off the scale of what you normally see here. Very, very few, they found that most human beings had a kind of certain area of happiness, and very, very few would be, you know, go very far on that scale, to the point where they were actually very happy. But here you had this whole population of people who all sort of ended up on the very far side of the scale. They were actually extremely happy compared to ordinary people, according to this research. And this was very fascinating, because the only reason that they could come up with why these Buddhist monks were happy in this way was precisely because of their spiritual practice. There didn't seem to be any possible other reason. Because as a monastic, you're taken away from a lot of the ordinary pleasures of life. And the only reason they could think of was because they had been practicing meditation, calm, loving kindness, compassion, virtue, and all these factors. And this is actually what had led to a change in their brain. And for neurosurgeons and for this particular trade, this was quite revolutionary, because as I understand, I'm not by far from being an expert on these matters, but I understand that very often, or previously, there had been this theory in neurosurgeon circles, neuroscience, that the brain is basically something which is fixed, the fixed entity, which is not, it cannot be changed very much. But what they were showing here was actually that it is possible to change the brain. The brain can be changed, and it can be done through spiritual practice. Through spiritual practice, you're literally changing the chemistry of the brain. So when you put the person through the machine after 30 years of practice, there's something has actually changed in there. Something has altered. And they did more experiments also with ordinary people who did meditation retreats, people who were practicing in other ways, just practicing virtue and goodness. And they showed a general pattern that people who were good, who did spiritual things, tended to be off the scale, so to speak, in these measurements they did with these particular machines, these brain scanning machines. And what is happening here, as I understand it, and this is the way I think, which is a good way of understanding what's going on here, is that when you do something good, you get some kind of happiness, which is spiritual happiness, based on something which is wholesome. Then, for example, say, for example, you spontaneously help somebody. You feel this urge to help somebody, and you do it. And you know what that can feel like. It can feel very nice. You get this kind of high from doing that. So you start off at a certain level. As I said before, we're all born at a particular level. And you have this high because you do something nice to somebody. But then when you come down again, you don't actually come down to the same level you were before. There is a residue there. There is like you have stepped up one little step in your level of happiness. So what you're doing here is that you're actually changing the baseline of your level of happiness up by doing something good, doing something wholesome. And this is what spiritual happiness is all about. Spiritual happiness is about changing that baseline, flat baseline, which goes through your life. And you can see how this works. Every time you do something good, you may get some happiness out of being good. Sometimes you may not get any particular happiness out of doing good. You may just restrain yourself from doing something bad, for example. But what is happening is that because you are doing something good, there's a slight increase there in your baseline. And every time you do something good, there's an increase. So it has like this cumulative effect, beautiful cumulative effect. So as you go out through your life practicing wholesome things, doing good things, you get this inclination where you're going upwards. So when you are born, you can be down here. When you die, you might be up here. This is the difference. So sensual pleasures, you end at the same point where you started. Spiritual happiness, you end up there. And that is the important distinction. And that is essentially what this experiment showed, because it showed that these people were abnormally happy, basically. The brain had been completely altered over 30 years of practice. And that was the remarkable thing. And you may ask, well, what happens if you continue going up and up like that? Where do you end? And I think you all know the answer to that. You obviously end. The highest point is obviously nirvana. That is the final destination, so to speak, of that curve. But that's what the spiritual life is about. Spiritual life is about going up and up and up and up a curve until you eventually reach the final destination point, which is nirvana itself. I personally find that very fascinating, that particular research, and I find it very useful in my own life. because it gave me some sense of what actually is happening when you practice spiritual happiness. And it gave me a kind of something to, a way of understanding what's going on. And I always found that that is very helpful when you do spiritual practice, because you actually get more incentive, in a sense, to practice a spiritual life. The question may arise, I'm not going to say all that much more actually, but the question may arise, well, how, what does this mean in practice? What does it mean? How do I actually have to change my life? Do I have to change my life dramatically from being a kind of a person who just indulges in the senses to becoming some spiritual, amazing spiritual person or something? What do I have to do? And I think it's an important question, because I remember once I had a discussion with a lady, and I think we were talking about the Noble Eightfold Path, and you may know that the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is called right thought, right intention, and part of that right thought and right intention is renunciation. And she said, "What?" And when I talked about this, she became a little bit upset, and she said, "Oh, what do you mean? Does this mean renunciation? That I have to give up all my Beethoven and Mozart CDs?" And she was a bit upset. I haven't seen her since. I wasn't very successful. But of course, no, it doesn't mean that at all. And this is the whole point. As a monk, of course, you cannot really listen to Beethoven and Mozart. But if you are not a monk, then of course you can listen to these things. That doesn't mean you have to give these things up. Doesn't mean that at all. That's not the point here. The point here is that you have to instead just change maybe your priorities a little bit. It means that when you realize that the spiritual life is what actually eventually leads to true contentment and happiness, it just means that you focus a little bit more on the spiritual life. You can live pretty much as before, but your priorities change a little bit. And in particular, it means that you, for example, if you decide that you want to live a virtuous and moral life, taking the five Buddhist precepts, for example, it means that certain of the sensual things become no longer accessible to you, because you realize that this is unwholesome, so you cut it off. So it limits your choice a little bit. I mean, for example, you know, if you take the five precepts, then you can no longer, be unfaithful, because that is against the five precepts. So that obviously limits your sort of sensual indulgence a little bit, but it's not so bad that most people can actually probably deal with that. And it also means that you cannot, if you want something something nice that you think you cannot afford, it means you cannot go and steal that thing, obviously. That's not the way to do it. So all it does really is that it narrows you down a little bit. It focuses your mind on the you can still live a life pretty much like everybody else, but it narrows you down a little bit to what you can do. And it also changes where you put your energies a little bit. Instead of putting a lot of energy into pursuing money and career and these things, you might put a little bit of that energy instead into doing something wholesome, doing something good, maybe doing some voluntary work somewhere, going on a meditation retreat, or whatever. Because you realize that, well, this is probably where, in the long run, this is where more happiness is to be found than in pursuing sensuality too much. It doesn't mean that it's wrong to have a career, certainly not. But again, it's a slight change of priorities, really. That's what I think it comes down to. Okay, you probably used to longer talks than this, but that's all I'm going to say tonight. So if anybody, I don't know, this is probably the time to ask some questions or comments if anybody wants to say anything. Anybody have any questions or comments they want to ask? Yes, down there. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. No, I don't think it was about that at all. Actually, I think it was just more about just ordinary brain research. What happens to the brain if people are happy? So just basically, you know, what actually physically goes on here in the brain? And it was. I don't think it had anything to do with non-self or that aspect of things at all. As far as I know. So yeah, but that's another interesting area as well there. But, yes. Yeah, I think I would agree with that. Yeah, yeah. But yeah. Yeah, but the thing is that, you know, it's a very frightening philosophy for people, this idea of non-self. But the reason it's frightening is because you have an idea of self in the first place. But what you are actually finding out when you realize non-self, I'm not making any claims here whatsoever, but this is just based on my understanding of this issue, is that you realize that there actually wasn't a self there in the first place. That's what you actually realize. So you realize it was a delusion all along. Yeah? So you're not, it's not as if you're taking away anything that was there. Yeah? So it is a death in a sense, but it's only the death of an illusion. It's death of a delusion, death of a wrong idea. That's really all it is. Yeah? So, you know, it can be, and this is what the Buddha says in the discourses, that he says that, well, you know, people are actually afraid of this because they think, I used to have a self, now I don't have one anymore. Huh? This is the whole point. But the point is that there isn't a self there in the first place. There's nothing to die. There's nothing which gets taken away from you. Huh? And that is an very important understanding, because it takes away some of the fear which is involved in this whole idea of non-self. Huh? Okay, anybody else wants to say anything? Yeah. Yes, sir. Okay, yeah, that's actually a very important point, I think, yeah. And for me, it's basically just experiential, and I should probably have said something about that during my talk, yeah. But this is what I have found personally, you know, after being 10 years as a monk, yeah, that basically it has been going like this over 10 years, up and up and up and up. And that is what is keeping me in the robes as a monk. Yeah? If it hadn't been going like that, why on earth would I want to be a monk? Yeah? And I have a feeling that the day that it starts to sort of go downhill, or maybe even flatten out, then who knows if I actually will be able to sustain it anymore. Yeah? Because there has to be some reason why you're a monk. I mean, you know, you don't take on all these strange rules and things for no reason. Yeah? Some of the rules, most of the rules are very good common sense, but some of them can seem a bit strange. Yeah? So I think that is the most important thing. It's basically that it is an experiential thing. Yeah, you know, you can actually feel within your own mind that over time, as you do this, you feel that there is an increase in happiness there. There's something actually going on. But of course, this is not something you can have a look. You cannot see these things in the short term. This is something you have to investigate over the long run. So you have to give, for example, things like the five precepts and generosity and these things. You have to give them some time to work. Yeah? Because when you are going up like that, the increments can be quite small. So each increment will be smaller. And it's actually the cumulative effect which really gives that, you know, gives a big change in your sense of happiness. But I have heard many people say that, you know, since they took on the five precepts, they feel much more contented. Their lives have been much more meaningful. They feel much better about things. So it's not, I think personally I have no doubt that it works. Sir. Yes, sir. yeah, I think that's probably part of it. I think that's part of it. But it's also just, I think, the whether you like yourself or not, I think it's just the purification of the mind. So when you keep the five precepts, when you do something good, you're actually purifying the mind. And a pure mind is something which feels, by its very nature, feels happy and is pleasant to be with. A mind, you know, I think the Buddha often describes it as if you do something bad, you have remorse. And it's not something you can control. You know, if you do something bad, remorse is an automatic condition which happens because you do something bad. And the automatic opposite is lack of remorse if you don't do something bad. So the pure mind is automatically happy here. So whether you like yourself or not, you know, in a sense it doesn't matter, because you bring a bit of a self into the picture. Whether that self is there or not is not the important issue. I think the important issue is just whether the mind is pure or not. But it's interesting, this whole idea of natural causality, which you see in Buddhism. According to Buddhism, there are all these natural causalities. how things actually work. And this, again, is what the Buddha understood on his night of enlightenment, this idea of natural causality, that certain things follow from other things, whether you like it or not. And one of those irrefutable laws, if you like, is the fact that if you do something immoral, something bad, you're not virtuous, you will feel remorse as a consequence. You may not, maybe you can suppress it to some extent, maybe you can deny it to a certain extent, but at the end of the day, it's one of those laws according to the Buddha's teachings. And then as you move along, as you become more virtuous, as remorse is taken away, as you practice this over time, then you come further and further away from whatever bad deeds you have done in the past, and you do more and more good deeds, then the non-remorse will become so strong that you will start to get pity in the mind, like gladness coming into the mind. You get then tranquility, and you have this sequence, tranquility, which leads to happiness, sukha, which then leads to samadhi. And samadhi is, you know, the deep stillnesses of the mind, which then can eventually give access to actually, for yourself, to see reality as it actually is, in the same way the Buddha saw it. Any more questions? Anybody? Yes, at the back there. Yes, yeah, that's right. No, not really. No, we did, that's right. That's actually one of the it's one of the eight precepts you take when you become, even before you become a monk. It's not actually taking part in any kind of entertainment or music. So yes, that's true. Apart from the chanting we do, which is a little bit musical, if you're lucky. Apart from that, no, we don't listen to music. Okay, any more questions? Okay, maybe we can pay our respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.